current state for Thursday. Welcome back. It's 90.5 WKAR. Counting down the hours until the legendary Friday before Christmas. Feels good. We're going to mark the occasion here today with a swig of beer before the show is through. For crying out loud, this would be Lansing Brewed Beer. That and more coming up in a pretty busy hour here we've got planned for you on Thursday. At the top of the program yesterday, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati overturned a federal district judge's ruling to grant the state an injunction that halted the proposed Key Wadin-Lansing Casino project. The ruling clears the way for the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians to proceed with its casino project, slated to be built near the Lansing Center downtown. And Lindsay Van Hulley's been covering this story for the Lansing State Journal. She joins us now by phone for a quick update. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I am well, thank you. This ruling from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned a federal district judge's injunction halting the casino plans. What was the court's reasoning for lifting the injunction?
Essentially, it said the district court in Grand Rapids lacked jurisdiction because it was basing its ruling in part on future events that may never actually happen. The tribe has not yet been, has not yet had land held in trust, the land it purchased near the Lansing Center, held in trust, and that's required by the federal government in order to have any casino built. And so, that's not necessarily a guarantee at this point. And so, the appeals court said, the state certainly has grounds to sue at a later time, but at this point it's a little bit premature.
Mm-hmm. Attorney General Schutte, Governor Snyder, and two other tribes oppose the Lansing Casino project for varying reasons. Has there been any reaction from them?
The opposing tribes, have said, it's off reservation, almost 300 miles, really, Lansing from Sault Ste. Marie. And so, part of that is it's, opening the casino potentially in an area that could compete. And also, the tribe really doesn't have the revenue sharing agreements with other tribes that's required under the state compact, and at least that's from the state's position.
Mm-hmm.
The state has said, they certainly could appeal. They've said, they're reviewing their options right now, and it sounds as though they may be interested in waiting to see what happens with the Bay Mills case, a similar case that's now in the Supreme Court.
Does that have any relevance to this, the Bay Mills case, I mean?
They're similar. They're different provisions, but they both sort of deal with a similar question in that, do states have the right to, to halt off-reservation gaming? Could have similar ramifications depending on how it goes.
The ruling, though significant, seems likely to be just one hurdle. What's the Sioux tribe's next move here?
For a while they've been sort of in a holding pattern, waiting to see what was going to happen with the legal process. Now they plan to actually formally apply to the Department of the Interior to actually have that land taken into trust. So that could happen as soon as next month, certainly sometime early 2014.
How many jobs are they projecting the casino could bring to the Lansing area?
At least right now, an estimated 2,200, and of those, 700 would be in construction.
And there's also the special fund planned for scholarships for Lansing High School students. Remind folks of the key details there, please.
They would, set aside essentially a portion of the electronic gaming revenue to create a scholarship, basically for Lansing High School students.
All right. We continue to keep an eye on it. I have a feeling we'll be keeping an eye on this one for a long, long time.
Lindsay, there's certainly more to come.
Yeah. Lindsay Van Hulley's a reporter for the Lansing State Journal. Thanks, Lindsay.
Thanks very much, Mark.
Well, the last few weeks have been eventful ones at the state capitol. Michigan legislators strongly considered measures involving education and phone service, among others. They passed controversial measures involving abortion insurance, medical marijuana, and others. And here to review some of those and to look back a bit on other 2013 Michigan news, we welcome MLive reporter Jonathan Osting, Susan Demas, owner-publisher of the Inside Michigan Politics newsletter, and Zach Gorchow, editor of of Gongwer News. Welcome back, one and all.
Morning.
Good
morning.
To see you. The Republican majority legislature pretty strongly disagreed with the Republican Secretary of State's proposal to identify donors to issue ads. Remind our listeners why legislators appear to disagree with Ruth Johnson. They're on the same team, aren't they?
Well, they are, but Republican legislators feel strongly that donors to these issue ads should be able to remain anonymous. That they are saying, well, this is a matter of free speech, that if you are known to be donating to these issue ads, which, to remind people, are ads where you don't expressly say vote for or against a candidate, but they look exactly like a campaign ad. It'll say, you know, Jane Smith is great or Jim Smith is terrible and so forth. And they, you know, are saying this is a matter of free speech. These are issue ads. The reality is that there is a donor community out there that wants to be able to contribute large sums of money into campaigns and remain anonymous.
Let's listen to Rich Robinson, who was a visitor on Current State not too long ago, Rich of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Here, Rich explains his take on the relevance of the Citizens United ruling regarding campaign finance.
Let me quote, "The First Amendment protects political speech, and disclosure permits citizens and shareholders to react to the speech of corporate entities in a proper way. This transparency makes the character, or allows the electorate to make informed decisions and give proper weight to different speeches and messages." This part of Citizens United was very clear. If there's any ambiguity, it's about what is or is not an issue advertisement or an issue message.
Susan Demas, what do you think?
Well, this has been the trend in politics ever since Citizens United, where anonymous donors are protected, and we see more and more money flowing in the system. It used to be the competitive congressional race might reach $1 million. Now that's kind of your opening bid. These races tend to be about $5 million. The U.S. Senate race that we'll see in Michigan could top $20 million. And a lot of times we will have no idea who is giving the money for these races. So in a way, this is just codifying the pattern for national and state politics for many, many years.
Jonathan, I'm wondering if you could help clarify Ruth Johnson's role in this. This started with the Secretary of State, and the legislature kind of took over. Did she punt on this or what?
Well, it actually started with the State Bar of Michigan. They requested Ruth Johnson take a look at the existing rule and see whether judicial elections specifically should, if issue ads should be allowed to play a role in those elections. Ruth Johnson said she couldn't look at just judicial elections, but she turned it around and proposed a rule that would require disclosure for any election season ads, so 30 days before a primary, 60 days before a general election, whether or not they use words like vote for or vote against. Ruth Johnson is the first to propose the administrative rule. Terry Lynn Land in 2006 also actually recommended that the legislature do something similarly. Mm-hmm. They never did. Ruth Johnson took matters into her own hands. The very next day, Republicans amended the bill to counteract what she was trying to do.
And what's being referred to an awful lot here is the fact that Governor Snyder campaigned on a platform of greater transparency, but he's been making sounds recently as if he may sign this.
Well, it wasn't just that he campaigned on transparency. I mean, he had put out a white paper that specifically said issue ads should be subject to the same disclosure as your standard campaign contribution. I mean, there was no ambiguity whatsoever. It's very clear he is laying the groundwork to walk that back and sign this bill. At least it sure seems that way. He is talking about, well, I've learned some things since I've been in office about the way things work. He's using this free speech argument. But it appears this is going to be one of the bigger flip-flops, if you will, of the Rick Snyder era.
He also did not take any political action committee money as well. That was a big part of his campaign. And then we've seen that he's had this nerd fund. So This kind of goes part and parcel with that.
Can you argue that, especially if Mr. Snyder signs the campaign reform measure, can you argue that Rick Snyder moved farther right in 2013?
Well, I mean, that's one issue of many. Obviously, with Medicaid expansion, people might say he took a step back towards the middle there, going against some of the far-right elements of his own party to expand access under the Affordable Care Act.
Common Core standards?
Core standards, yeah. I mean, I don't think you can look at just one issue and make that judgment call.
Okay. Also, just last week, let's talk about the timeline. Is the timeline important here?
In terms of signing the campaign finance bill? Well, he has 14 days to do it. I think it's important because there's two Fridays in that window, and we might see this signed on a Friday afternoon to try and avoid a lot of media scrutiny. That's just a guess.
Also, just last week, the legislature easily passed a citizen ballot initiative undertaken by Michigan Right to Life that foremost removes abortion coverage from standard health insurance policies. The governor's not on the hot seat here since it was a citizen initiative, so it just became law. This debate got quite dramatic, arguably most dramatic, when Senate Majority Leader Gretchen Whitmer of East Lansing characterized the measure as requiring rape insurance. Here's the senator.
And for those of you who want to act aghast that I'd use a term like rape insurance to describe the proposal here in front of us, you should be even more offended that it's absolutely accurate description of what this proposal requires. This tells women that were raped and became pregnant that they should have thought ahead and bought special insurance for it.
The majority went on to pass this measure. Susan Demas, do you expect repercussions?
Well, what this does is take the issue off the table for the 2014 election. If the legislature had not acted, then citizens would have had to vote on it, which potentially could have helped Democratic turnout. So potentially Democrats might turn out more because they're upset about this, but there's a long way to go before 2014. I think probably the most surprising thing about this debate was that Senator Whitmer actually disclosed that she had been raped. And that was a very emotional speech to hear on the floor. It did not change the outcome, but there were several women and men who shared their personal stories. And certainly there are a lot of people who feel strongly about this in the electorate.
What men shared their stories?
Senator Jim Ananick talked about the fact that he and his wife had suffered a miscarriage.
Okay. Any other response to that very dramatic debate?
Well, I mean, I think it definitely left a lot of people pretty stunned when Senator Whitmer gave her speech. But it did not move votes. The legislature has a very solid majorities in both houses of members who have been endorsed by Right to Life of Michigan. And, while there was some discomfort maybe among some sectors of, staff and leadership about what the political ramifications of this might be, for the rank and file members on the Republican side, this was, they were going to vote for this, no speech was going to change their mind.
Mm-hmm. In terms of 2014, there is some talk about trying to put together another petition drive for a referendum. I believe Planned Parenthood, ACLU, were meeting this week to discuss whether they were going to move forward with that effort. And again, the ramifications for 2014 aren't entirely clear. Abortion as a wedge issue has traditionally benefited pro-life candidates, but opponents of this measure will point out that this isn't just about abortion insurance. It's about interfering in the private marketplace, and polling showed that it was pretty unpopular.
Has anyone looked at the cost of what this rider would be?
There's not a lot of information out there. You've heard people say that in the handful of other states that have similar laws, that it's a little bit hard to find them. And the insurance companies in Michigan, the HMOs, Blue Cross, are all basically saying, we don't know what this is. We're looking at the law. We're not sure what we're going to offer. We don't know what it's going to cost. According to the Department of Community Health, something like 3% of abortions in Michigan right now are paid by insurance, that most of them are paid out of pocket, as is. So it's really unknown territory. The law takes effect March 14th, presuming there is no referendum, and it's going to be uncharted territory at that point.
We're talking about the December and Well, we will be talking more about what happened previously in 2013 here with Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News, Susan Demas of Inside Michigan Politics, and Jonathan Osting of MLive. The latest survey numbers from last week's State of the State survey showed the governor rebounding in his approval ratings from the drop a year ago after Right to Work. Admittedly, this was only up to a 35% approval, but that's still high enough to win re-election, according to Charlie Ballard, the director of the State of the State survey. How damaging to the governor's re-election campaign could these two measures that we've been talking about, how damaging could they be?
Well, because Rick Snyder didn't have to sign the abortion legislation, and he actually vetoed that last year, he has an out with that one. So I think that's positive. As far as campaign finance goes, that tends to be inside baseball. Most people don't tend to vote on campaign finance issues, so I think he's okay. I think more salient issues will be the pension tax. Even though that was 2011, people are still not very happy, and we have to pay our taxes every year, so you get a reminder. And potentially Right to Work and some of those other lame duck issues that went through at a very fast pace in 2012. But I think the State of the State survey reflects what a lot of polling has shown, that Rick Snyder's numbers are on the upswing, however modestly.
I'm so curious. Those you spend time at the Capitol, do legislative Republicans, do you pick up the feeling that legislative Republicans feel that they are vulnerable next year?
I don't think so. I think, you know, there's always a sense that you can't take things for granted, that, you know, you've got to work hard, you've got to do all the things. But if you look at the dynamics today, it looks like a pretty favorable environment for Republicans. Number one, it's the non-presidential election year, which for the last 20 years, with one exception, has been very favorable climate for Republicans in Michigan. Fewer Democrats turn out, and they have done very well. You have a president who's a Democrat, and in general, with some exceptions, in the midterm election, the president's party, which in this case, of course, is the Democratic Party, does poorly or worse than the party not in office in the midterm election. And you have the president's popularity numbers are really falling right now in response to what's been going on with the Affordable Care Act. You have a governor who's a Republican seeking re-election. Since we went to the four-year term for governors in the 60s, no Michigan incumbent governor running for a second term has lost, and incumbents overall are 6-1 in that time. So you look at all these dynamics, and I think the Republicans probably feel pretty good about where they're situated.
Jonathan, what do you make of it?
Yeah, I have to agree with Zach. I mean, I think, you know, Democrats are looking at a few seats here and there that they think they can pick up, but I don't know if it's going to be enough to win a majority in either chamber. They actually might have some opportunities in the Senate side, but the majority there is so strong for Republicans that it's actually a super majority right now that Democrats are unlikely to really, you know, make a significant impact there.
Of course, the interesting question, too, is to consider who the Republicans are more vulnerable to, Democrats or Tea Party.
Yeah, sure.
No, I mean
part of this campaign finance bill was actually it was going to allow caucuses to spend during the primary season, and Tea Partiers came out and just blasted that. They called it the Incumbent Protection Act and suggested, you know, House Republican Caucus or House Senate Republican Caucus were trying to protect their own members at the expense of upstart grassroots challengers. That provision was taken out of the bill.
Among everything that happened in 2013 in Michigan, not just at the state capitol necessarily, what do you think you'll remember most vividly from the year?
I will probably remember Senator Whitmer's speech most vividly. I've seen a lot of political speeches, a lot of speeches on the Senate and House floors. That was far and away the most emotional one that I've seen. I think it came as a shock to a lot of people because, you know, we have discussed issues of rape and abortion many times, and this is the first time that Senator Whitmer actually disclosed her own personal history.
Zach, what do you think?
In terms of one moment, there's no doubt that Senator Whitmer's speech was it. As far as overall, kind of the big story of the year, I mean, there were really two big stories. One was the Medicaid expansion debate, which really just dominated everything and is going to be so influential in the elections next year. And then the Detroit bankruptcy was just a constant story, Detroit being put under an emergency manager. That feels like it was 3 years ago now, but it was this year.
And Jonathan?
Yeah, a couple that were mentioned already, but obviously Whitmer's moment was extremely emotional and touching, even though you try and be impartial as a reporter, you couldn't help but feel an emotional response there. As far as the Medicaid debate, Snyder, his famous mantra of take a vote, not a vacation, when the Senate decided to leave town without voting on Medicaid expansion, maybe backfired on him in some respects. I mean, the Senate Republicans did not take too kindly to that, and he ended up, avoiding that phrase in future public speaking events after a discussion with Randy Richardville, but it was certainly memorable.
Certainly. If you had to narrow it down to six words, those were probably the most memorable six words of 2013. So we had another pretty serious dust-up accompanied the move by Republicans to move the Michigan Court of Claims from Ingham County Circuit Court to the State Court of Appeals. Republicans say it's wrong that all the lawsuits coming at the state are decided by only 3% of the state's electorate. Here's a taste of how that played out on Current State.
Yes, it is political maneuvering. When a bill is introduced 2.5 weeks ago that completely revises the entire judicial system of this state, where there was no impact or no input from the Court of Appeals, they weren't even advised of this, where there was no input from us or the Michigan Bar Association, no effort to make up some court rules as to how this is supposed to happen. This was done secretly, quietly, behind the scenes. My information is that this bill has been sitting around for a long time in various forms, and this is the final one. And they were waiting for an opportunity to present it when they thought it was right.
That was Ingham County Circuit Court Judge William Collette. Let's go now to State Senator Rick Jones.
Why would it all be in one county? It makes no sense. It's quite a burden to that county. And I wondered, well, when did this get changed? Well, it got changed in the 70s. So I contend if there were any political shenanigans, they were done in the 70s when you focused Court of Claims in simply one county.
Again, Judge Collette and Senator Jones, Jonathan Osting, your takeaway from the Court of Claims drama.
Well, Rick Jones is obviously biting the bullet on this one, but I think it's a stretch to suggest that it was simply his idea that came to him and decided like a good time to run it. I mean, obviously political motivations here, and obviously the bill. Some people call it needed a fix or a clarification in at least one area regarding a right to jury trial. So Republicans moved it through, even though they knew that it still needed some work. So there was clearly a rush to get it done by a certain point.
Susan, anything to add there?
Well, we've seen that Republicans have not been thrilled with this Ingham County court setup for a long time. And the right to work bill, actually, it bypassed that initial level so that they didn't have to deal with Judge William Collette in particular, who had knocked down so many of Governor Snyder's proposals. So we kind of had a little foreshadowing there last year that their desire would be to take some action to move some significant cases out of Democratic Ingham County.
And Zach, anything?
I mean,
on
it was a it was a brazen political move. I mean, most of the judges on the Ingham Circuit Court either were elected with Democratic backing, were appointed, have clear Democratic ties. Now, of course, they'll say, "Look, I run my run my court in a nonpartisan fashion." But I mean, look, most judges have some political history, and in the case of Ingham County, it's almost overwhelmingly Democratic, and the Republicans, like Susan said, were sick of the way that the Ingham Court was ruling on a lot of these cases. And so they moved it out of there into the Court of Appeals. So this was, for the judiciary in Michigan, this was a real bomb. I mean, people are still trying to figure out the ramifications of this. There are cases all across the state and other circuit courts that are going to go to this new Court of Claims under this law. It didn't just affect Ingham County. Now, any lawsuit against the state starts in this new Court of Claims as opposed to the Saginaw Circuit Court or the Wayne Circuit Court and so forth.
What about the 3% argument?
Well, Democrats humorously, I guess, pointed out during the abortion insurance debate that, in fact, fewer than 4% of the state's population signed that, and Republican lawmakers were still happy to, allow their voice to essentially dominate the conversation by approving that bill. It was certainly funny, but I guess it goes both ways. I mean, certainly the Ingham County argument makes sense. Only 3% of the state is represented by those judges, or elects those judges.
We referred to Detroit previously. It was a chaotic year for the city of Detroit. The state filed for bankruptcy. Eligibility for bankruptcy was legally declared by Judge Stephen Rhodes. City voters elected Detroit's first white mayor in decades. As we wrap up 2013, Susan, is there more Detroit controversy behind us or ahead of us?
I think everybody is hoping that it's behind us. There will still be drama because we have to see how the bankruptcy plays out, how it plays out in particular with pensions, which is such a highly politically charged and emotional issue. We also have to see how Mayor Duggan will work with the city council. In the past, the city council has not exactly been a great partner for any mayor. And we have to see how much power Mike Duggan will really have, since there still is an emergency manager in place who really has all the power.
The big moment is yet to come, which is that Kevin Orr, the emergency manager in Detroit, appointed by Governor Snyder, has to propose what's called a plan of action, which is essentially how he plans to try to wipe the slate clean of Detroit's debt, get everything in order financially. And that's going to be brutal. I mean, how is it going to affect pensions? How will the Detroit Institute of Arts be affected? And right on down the line, is this going to be able to set the stage for the city to be on a good financial footing without just creating utter, chaos for retirees and others in the city who count on city services?
I can't help but wonder if it's going to wear thin for Mike Duggan. Here he is, the newly elected mayor of Detroit, and he's in this bizarre role where he's kind of waiting to become the real mayor of the city of Detroit.
Yeah, Duggan actually came and visited Lansing last month, and you could tell he was already a little weary about that discussion. He didn't really know what his power was going to be, and it seemed like it was dawning on him that at least initially, after campaigning so hard for so long, he probably won't have any power initially.
Let's move back to the state one more time, take that statewide approach. Do you expect the Republican legislative agenda to be less controversial in 2014 in an effort to dial down the memory of hot-button topics like the abortion rider right to work? Susan, you alluded to this earlier.
It's an election year, so I don't think we'll see very much done at all besides the budget, which they're constitutionally required to do. Lame duck 2014 will be a lot of fun once the election is over.
Okay. Zach, any thoughts?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've talked to folks who've said, they're basically telling, their clients, when I say folks, I mean lobbyists, they're telling their clients, anything that's a really heavy lift is going to have to wait until lame duck. That doesn't mean nothing's going to happen. There will be issues worked on, but the big stuff probably doesn't happen until after the election.
And what kind of shape are our key candidates for office in here at the end of 2013? Let's get away from the governor's race for just one second. Talk about Terry Lynn Landing and Gary Peters.
Gary Peters is kind of the Democratic heir apparent to Carl Levin, although, early polling shows Terry Lynn Land is actually holding her own in that race. These polls are so early, I think, like we see with Mark Schauer on the governor's side, a lot of people don't know who these candidates are yet, and opinions are going to change significantly, I think, over the next year.
What are you going to be watching in 2014 most closely, Susan?
Which race?
Any story, actually.
Any story?
Yeah.
I'm very interested to see how the unemployment issue plays out, because 43,000 Michiganders are losing their benefits in January, and that's something that nobody is talking about.
Zach?
I mean, I think in the end that the governor's race is gonna drown out everything else. I mean, Rick Snyder, there's been so much that's happened the past 3 years that in the end that this election is really going to be a referendum on his era, his first term. And for the Democrats, they absolutely have to find a way to either beat him or win control of the House, so they're looking at another, at least two really bad years for them in the legislature.
And Jonathan?
I'm curious to see what happens with gay marriage, gay rights issues in Michigan. You know, there could be an important federal ruling involving Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage. And also, you know, Republican lawmakers are talking about updating the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act, although if that happens, it probably won't be until lame duck as well. But in the wake of Dave Ajema's latest anti-gay rhetoric, I think a lot of Republicans are hoping to make a little progress on that issue.
I'll just remind everybody that the federal government has yet to respond to Michigan's health care waiver requests. There hasn't been any yet, and if the answer comes back no, the impact there could be serious impact on Medicaid expansion in Michigan, as I understand it anyway. We want to thank all of our three guests here today. It's been a great discussion. Zach Gorchow is the editor at Gongmer News. Susan Demas is the owner-publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. And Jonathan Osting reports for MLive. Thanks, one and all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. The Lansing Symphony Orchestra's Holiday Pops concert is Sunday at Wharton Center. Current State's Melissa Benmark spoke with conductor Timothy Muffet about the music, starting with some pieces that will include local students. It's part of an orchestra outreach called Side by Side.
Well, Side by Side is a program we've been running for a few years now, where it's an outreach program where we give the opportunity for some very gifted high school students to sit in with the orchestra and perform with us on stage in a concert. And, you know, typically our Holiday Pops programs, kind of going back to the Arthur Fiedler tradition, go from popular classical music to just popular music. And so we want to give these young people a meaningful experience. So they play on the classical portion, and this year they're going to play the Skater's Waltz and the L'Arlésienne movement from Bizet's L'Arlésienne Suite and the Victor Herbert March of the Toys, some of the great, really, you know, light classical music from this season. And then we meet with them on the day before the concert. They have a rehearsal with me, and then we have mentors from the symphony who work with the individuals and the individual sections. And so it's, I think, really a great experience for them to have some very meaningful, practical, hands-on experience and exposure to the world of being a professional musician.
Tell me a little bit about your soprano soloist.
Mara Bonde is probably the perfect Holiday pop singer on the planet, in my opinion, because especially for a program like we do here, where we need someone who's able to sing something like an aria from Handel's Messiah, but then also able to pull off Santa Baby on the second half of the program.
Right, that's a wide range.
It's a wide range, and Mara is, well, actually we worked together on a concert in Connecticut where she sang The Barber, Knoxville, summer 1915, beautifully. And then I found out that she does these things too. And on her resume is the Boston Pops, for example. So, you know, this is someone who works at the very highest level. And I've done many concerts with her. And I can't wait to introduce her to the Lansing audience. I mean, audiences just love her work.
You have a couple of arrangements of carols on here by someone named Bradford, who I am not familiar with. Who is Bradford?
Well, Barlow Bradford is a composer, an American composer out, I think he lives in the Northwest, Oregon or Washington, I can't remember. But he is, in my opinion, just one of the great arrangers of Christmas music. I've been doing his arrangements for several years now, and you know, I would do one or two, and I think, wow, that's really extraordinary. But now that I've done probably 10 of his arrangements over the years, and realizing that this guy is really a very special voice in American music, and is taking this music that is so familiar to us and setting it in these really remarkable, fresh settings that are quite artful in their own way. We're doing one Infant Holy, Infant Lowly, that, in my opinion, may be the most beautifully arranged piece of Christmas music I've ever heard. And I'm also noticing this, not by design, but sort of by just natural gravity, that more and more the Holiday Pops programs I program are a Barlow Bradford Christmas, because there's just no one that's writing arrangements that surpass his. It's really extraordinary.
Well, from Percy Faith to Barlow.
Right. And we're really excited about having the Arts Chorale with us on this program. One of our, you know, our fine local community ensembles, vocal ensembles. This is that great Midwestern singing tradition at its best, our Arts Chorale. We're just really excited to have them with us.
So I was going to give you a rough time about having to conduct Sleigh Ride for the umpteen millionth time, but it appears that a guest conductor will be doing that.
Yes, I have to relinquish the baton to someone else, and you know, the Lansing Symphony and orchestras all across the country rely heavily on the generosity of individuals and corporations for our existence. And sometimes we have to get kind of creative in the way we approach the fundraising process. And so we've auctioned off the opportunity to conduct the orchestra in Sleigh Ride. And Beth Anthony will be the Sleigh Ride guest conductor for 2013, and we're looking forward to having her with us.
Do you think you can take having a year without?
I love Sleigh Ride. I mean, it's one of the great American masterpieces, absolutely. And I mean that. I mean, it's a terrific piece of music, certainly. But I'll be enjoying it from the sidelines.
Timothy Muffet, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Bemark.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us today. The European Space Agency launched a new satellite into space this morning, hoping to produce the most accurate three-dimensional map of the Milky Way ever and to better understand the evolution of our galaxy. The satellite, named Gaia, will study 1 billion stars in the galaxy, or roughly, that's 1%. Of the Milky Way's 100 billion stars. Gaia, which is named after an ancient Greek deity, has a planned lifetime of 5 years. That is one multitasking satellite, 1 billion stars. And if Gaia is still operational after that, scientists say they might extend its mission for up to 2 more years. Over the past decade, there's been tremendous growth in Michigan-based breweries. There's Founders in Grand Rapids, there's Bell's, of course, in Kalamazoo, Atwater in Detroit, and in Lansing, of course, there's nothing. Our next two guests are hoping to change that. Matt Jason and Jeremy Sprague are working to open a brewery and distillery on Lansing's east side. The creators of Sleepwalker Spirits and Ale have a unique startup plan. They're inviting members of the community to become co-owners of their business. Matt Jason and Jeremy Sprague, welcome to Current State.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having us.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Sure. How long has this idea been kicking around, Matt?
It's been kicking around for years, probably a good 5-6 years now, since Jeremy and I started talking about this over a couple beers at Amel's over on Michigan Avenue. And we've been working on it steadily ever since.
And why do you feel Lansing needs a brewery, Jeremy?
I think Lansing needs a brewery in downtown Lansing. I think there are a couple of sort of, we do have a couple of breweries on the outskirts in Mason, and then there's another one out on Kreitz Road. But having something sort of downtown Lansing is really important because I think that communities sort of, you know, crowd around breweries and they, whether or not they are, you know, involved in ownership or not, they do sort of have a sense of, this is my brewery, this is where I come from, these beers reflect, you know, our community and who we are, you know, as a community.
And so, we're also the capital of a great beer state,
we've got
to represent.
Michigan does have a rich brewing heritage, there's no doubt about that. Jeremy, what knowledge did you have about brewing when this idea first started getting discussed?
Around 5 years ago or so, when Matt first wanted to talk to me about distilling, my dad has been a home brewer for quite a long time. He bought me a kit, which sat in my closet for about a decade, or at least 5 years, I should say, before I started brewing with Matt.
You were a beer drinker, though,
a big
at
beer
that
drinker,
point.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Big
okay.
fan. When
okay.
I, you know, I used to live in Boston, and my first big exposure to craft beer would have been with Harpoon and Sam Adams. So that was sort of where it started for me back in the, I'd say mid-90s. And coming back here, jumping into brewing, I started brewing five years ago or so with Matt. And
did you take classes?
We did. I did take a class at the Siebel Institute. It was sort of an online class for about 3 months, and that helped my brewing a lot. It sort of, there was some biochemistry and some things that sort of made me think a lot harder about how I was brewing and how to keep things a lot cleaner and just have a better end product.
And Matt, talk to us about this community-owned model. How does community ownership of this project, how would that work?
Right. So we've looked at some different models. We know that there's a big demand for having a destination like this, a business like this. And we actually found some inspiration from the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And there's a number of businesses that were created, frameworks that were created to maintain businesses that the community wanted. And so we went through an extensive process with the state to get approval to bring on four times as many investors as a typical corporation. So a normal S corporation can have up to 25 investors. And we went through a process where we had to share our books, our plans with the state, and we were approved to bring on four times that many. And so in that way, we can have many more investors at a lower minimum buy-in. And so by the definition, some of the definitions that float around out there in terms of what a community-owned business or corporation is that you have local ownership. And so we've made it so that residents of Lansing can be able to invest in actually own this company, and then you have more of a democratic model, and we're looking to have semi-annual meetings of our owners and have them help us guide the operation of the business.
Do you have all your prospective owners lined up, or you're in the middle of that process?
We're in the middle of it.
Okay.
We've taken on many.
And are you saying, now, is my math off, or are you looking for 100?
We're not looking necessarily for 100, but we've been approved for that many.
Correct.
It would be nice, just in terms of bookkeeping, to have fewer than that.
Okay.
And right now, at the rate we're going, we would probably need about between 30 and 40 investors at the rate how many shares folks are buying at this point.
Okay.
And right now, we're through about a dozen, so we're making really good progress.
Okay. Most people would argue that you can't have enough good beer, but the craft brew market in Michigan is healthy. Why do you think there's room for Sleepwalker Spirits and Ale?
I think that if you look at the numbers, I think that craft beer is going to be growing for many years to come. I think that market share-wise, isn't that right, Matt?
Yeah. And
from the big three, we're still looking at every year.
And there's also a difference between trying to get into distribution and also providing a place for people to come. And so, you know, the shelves right now are packed of craft beer, And that is a pretty tight market. But particularly in Lansing, there is, we feel, an underserved market for actual places, producers of craft beer. And also, a large part of what we're doing is spirits. And in the spirits industry, there's a huge amount of room for growth right now. It's where craft beer was, you know, perhaps a decade or more ago. And really for us, we're looking to make spirits and distribute those pretty heavily from the beginning. And we think that will become a big hallmark of our business. So the beer is there because beer is popular. We make good beer. And we think people will enjoy it. But the spirits, they complement each other, and we think the spirits will really what will carry us.
What kind of spirits are you looking at?
We'll be a whiskey house.
Okay.
Primarily. So lots of white whiskey, along with we'll start barrel aging immediately. So.
And this is also about creating a space. What spaces are you looking at?
There are tons of
east side. You want it on the east side of Lansing.
Yeah, there's a mix of places that we've looked at, and we need a place that's large enough. We'll need to both produce and have a tasting room, and a pub. So probably we're going to need at least 3,000 to 4,000 square feet. There are some restrictions with distilling that are different than beer, but we feel like there are enough places around, whether it's been on the east side that we've looked, Rio Town, that we feel that there will be something available when we're capitalized.
That would probably give Rio Town a real shot in the arm.
Well, there's a lot of really cool things happening in Rio Town right now. You know, we're sort of, at this point, Matt and I are keeping our finger on the pulse of sort of everywhere across the city just to see what's happening with the real estate and what types of new businesses are popping up. So
we have a bottle of your beer here. This is called Kinky Brown. Jeremy or Matt, why don't you crack that baby open? And I mean, it's almost Friday. It's Friday somewhere. We're talking with Matt, Jason, and Jeremy Sprague here, who are the planners of a new community-owned brewery and distillery, Sleepwalker Spirits and Ale. Hopefully that's not for me. I'm not going to be able to drink all of that. I'm going to need a barrel of French roast to recover from this much at this rate here. So
me too.
I'm going to have a swig here.
This is a brown ale, Matt's recipe.
Delightful. Where was this brewed then?
This is brewed, I believe, at my house.
This one was, yeah. Okay.
Boy, you've been doing your homework, Jeremy. Nice work.
This was, I think the original batch we made was called the East Side Kinky Brown because some hops from my backyard made it into the fermenter. And there's a story behind it. I don't know if we've got a chance to share that or not.
Yeah,
about
behind
the name.
It. Sure.
Jeremy really pushed me into using hops a lot more than I typically was used to. And he's very inventive in his brewing, and he's been throwing pumpkins into his batches lately. And so I decided to dry hop this brown ale. And this was inspired by a couple good beers out there. One of them is Good Humans by Shorts. And it's a dry hopped brown ale as well. So I threw these hops in. He's like, well, you know, you've got to filter those out. You can't leave the hops in the beer because they'll get in the bottles, they'll get in the kegs. And he's very fastidious. So I said, okay, well, you know, what's the best way to do that? He's like, well, here, this is what I use. And so he gave me a pair of his wife's pantyhose. They were new. They weren't used, and we always sanitize our equipment.
Sanitized.
But the first batch we served of that, I think, was at a fundraiser for the Allen Neighborhood Center, and it was a great little story to go with it. So that was our East Side Kinky Brown because that batch happened to be made with some hops from my backyard. But Jeremy's wife, her maiden name also happens to be Brown, so it works out pretty well.
Yeah. Kinky Brown is born.
Yeah, it was double meaning there.
Where did Sleepwalker? Where did that name come from?
You know, we were having a spaghetti dinner with both of our families, our kids and our wives, and we were kicking around a couple of names, and it really was a 50-50 combo. It was almost like Sesame Street. Sleepwalker, Sleepwalker, and they came together, and it was really funny. It happened just like that.
It's got some cool aspects to it. We feel some of it's kind of open to interpretation, which we like. And but we've also, you know, Jeremy and I would talk a lot in our planning as I was finishing my day and he was heading off to work as a musician, and we'd notice the moon a lot. And that became a big part of our logo and who we are. And then our motto, Dream Play, comes from the Japanese word for sleepwalker, which includes the characters for dream, play, and person. And so we want to evoke the spirit to dream and play.
Very interesting. And when you talk to people just at large about your idea, what's the typical response?
The typical response is very positive.
It's about
people
time.
Are very excited. Exactly. And especially, the distilling component is going to be pretty awesome. So.
And there will be a number of microbreweries coming on board in Lansing. So, you know, that's, I think, something that people should be looking forward to. And
Lansing can support, you know, easily up to 2 to 3.
We're just about out of time. Tell our listeners about your event tonight.
Well, tonight at the Allen Marketplace, we're having an investor presentation, startup sleepwalker event, where we will be giving a short presentation, as well as answering questions about Sleepwalker. We'll be sharing 6 different styles of beer. And
that's what time?
6:30.
6:30 to 8:30,
yep,
right?
Allen Everett Center. Some samples, a presentation. Some investors will also be on hand.
Yeah, that's the cool thing, too. Investors will be able to sort of also share where we're at, we're headed.
Outstanding. We want to thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you for having us.
Matt Jason and Jeremy Sprague are the founders of Sleepwalker Spirits and Ale. Again, the event Startup Sleepwalker will take place tonight at the Allen Market Marketplace off of Kalamazoo. Bottoms up.
Cheers.
Thanks, fellas.
Ça sent la bière de Londres à Berlin. Ça sent la bière, Dieu qu'on est bien. Ça sent la bière de Londres à Berlin. Ça sent la bière, donne-moi la main. C'est plein d'Eulenspiegel et de ses cousins et d'arrière-cousins de Bruegel l'ancien. C'est plein de vent.
Ah, the smell of beer. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we explore the gustatory delights and oddities of the Midwest. Food writer Peggy Wilson talks about her new book called Fried Walleye and Cherry Pie, Midwestern Writers on Food. Also, Current State contributor Scott Southard reviews a Dickens classic. That and more Friday, the Friday before Christmas. On Current State, the executive producer of our show is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to producers Emmanuel Berry, Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, and Scott Pohl, as well as to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.